magnificent amulet. When his fingers drummed on the back of my chair, his rings and platinum Rolex flashed. If I'd seen him in the mortal world, I might have guessed he was a young Native American billionaire casino owner. But here in the Duat, with that crescent-shaped amulet around his neck...
Moon Pie!
Ra cackled with delight. You're Hans, I guessed. The moon god. He gave me a wolfish grin, looking at me as if I were an appetizer.
At your service, he said. Care to play a game?
Not you, Bess growled.
Hans spread his arms in a big air hug.
Bess, old buddy, how've you been?
Don't old buddy me, you scam artist.
I'm hurt. Hans sat down on my right and leaned toward me conspiratorially.
Poor Bess gambled with me ages ago, you see. He wanted more time with Bost. He wagered a few feet of his height. I'm afraid he lost.
That's not what happened, Bess roared.
Gentlemen, my father said in his sternest dad tone, you are both guests at my table. I won't have any fighting.
Absolutely, Osiris.
Hans beamed at him.
I'm honored to be here. And these are your famous children. Wonderful. Are you ready to play, kids?
Julius, they don't understand the risks,
our mother protested.
We can't let them do this.
Hang on, Sadie said. Do what, exactly? Hans snapped his fingers and all the food on the table disappeared, replaced by a glowing silver Senate board.
Haven't you heard about me, Sadie? Didn't Isis tell you some stories? Or not? Now there was a gambler. The sky goddess wouldn't stop playing until she'd won 5 whole days from me. Do you know the odds against winning that much time? Astronomical! Of course, she's covered with stars, so I suppose she is astronomical.
Hans laughed at his own joke. He didn't seem bothered that no one joined him.
I remember, I said. You gambled with Nut and she won enough moonlight to create 5 extra days, the demon days. That let her get around Ra's commandment that her 5 children couldn't be born on any day of the year.
Nuts!
Ra muttered.
Bad nuts!
The moon god raised an eyebrow.
Dear me, Ra is in bad shape, isn't he? But yes, Carter Kane, you're absolutely right. I'm the moon god, but I also have some influence over time. I can lengthen or shorten the lives of mortals. Even gods can be affected by my powers. The moon is changeable, you see. Its light waxes and wanes. In my hands, time can also wax and wane. You need, what, about 3 extra hours? I can weave that for you out of moonlight if you and your sister are willing to gamble for it. I can make it so that the gates of the 8th house have not yet closed.
I didn't understand how he could possibly do that. Back up time, insert 3 extra hours into the night. But for the first time since Sunny Acres, I felt a small spark of hope. If you can help, why not just give us the extra time? The fate of the world is at stake. Hans laughed.
Good one! Give you time! No, seriously. If I started giving away something that valuable, Mott would crumble. Besides, you can't play Senate without gambling. Bess can tell you that.
Bess spit a chocolate grasshopper leg out of his mouth.
Don't do it, Carter. You know what they said about Hans in the old days? Some of the pyramids have a poem about him carved into the stones. It's called the Cannibal Hymn. For a price, Hans would help the pharaoh slay any gods who were bothering him. Hans would devour their souls and gain their strength.
The moon god rolled his eyes.
Ancient history, Bess. I haven't devoured a soul in... What month is this? March? At any rate, I've completely adapted to this modern world. I'm quite civilized now. You should see my penthouse at the Luxor in Las Vegas. I mean, thank you! America has a proper civilization.
He smiled at me, his silver eyes flashing like a shark's.
So what do you say, Carter? Sadie, play me at Senate. 3 pieces for me, 3 for you. You'll need 3 hours of moonlight, so you two will need one additional person to stake a wager. For every piece your team manages to move off the board, I'll grant you an extra hour. If you win, that's 3 extra hours. Just enough time to make it past the gates of the 8th house.
And if we lose? I asked.
Oh, you know.
Hans waved his hand as if this were an annoying technicality.
For each piece I move off the board, I'll take a wren from one of you.
Sadie sat forward.
You take our secret names? As in, we have to share them with you?
Share.
Hans stroked his ponytail as if trying to remember the meaning of that word.
No, no sharing. I'll devour your wren, you see.
Erase part of our souls, Sadie said. Take our memories, our identity.
The moon god shrugged.
On the bright side, you wouldn't die. You'd just
turn into a vegetable, Sadie guessed. Like Ra there. Don't want vegetables,
Ra muttered irritably. He tried to chew on Bess's shirt, but the dwarf god scooted away.
3 hours, I said. Wagered against 3 souls.
Carter, Sadie, you don't have to do this, my mother said. We don't expect you to take this risk.
I'd seen her so many times in pictures and in my memories, but for the first time it really struck me how much she looked like Sadie, or how much Sadie was starting to look like her. They both had the same fiery determination in their eyes. They both tilted their chins up when they were expecting a fight, and they both weren't very good at hiding their feelings. I could tell from Mom's shaky voice that she realized what had to happen. She was telling us we had options, but she knew very well that we didn't. I looked at Sadie, and we came to a silent agreement.
Mom, it's okay, I said.
You gave your life to close Apophis's prison. How can we back out?
Hans rubbed his hands. Ah, yes, Apophis's prison. Your friend Menshikov is there right now, loosening the serpent's bonds. I have so many bets on what will happen.
Will you get there in time to stop him? Will you return Ra to the world? Will you defeat Menshikov?
I'm giving 100 to 1 on that.
Mom turned desperately to my father.
Julius, tell them. It's too dangerous.
My dad was still holding a plate of half-eaten birthday cake. He stared at the melting ice cream as if it were the saddest thing in the world.
Carter and Sadie, he said at last, I brought Hans here so that you'd have the choice. But whatever you do, I'm still proud of you both. If the world ends tonight, that won't change.
He met my eyes, and I could see how much it hurt him to think about losing us. Last Christmas at the British Museum, he'd sacrificed his life to release Osiris and restore balance to the Duat. He'd left Sadie and me alone, and I'd resented him a long time for that. Now I realized what it was like to be in his position. He'd been willing to give up everything, even his life, for a bigger purpose.
I understand, Dad, I told him. We're Canes. We don't run from hard choices.
He didn't answer, but he nodded slowly. His eyes burned with fierce pride.
For once, Sadie said, Carter's right. Hans, we'll play your stupid game.
Excellent, Hans said. That's 2 souls, 2 hours.
He didn't answer, but he nodded slowly. His eyes burned with fierce pride.
For once, Sadie said, Carter's right. Hans, we'll play your stupid game.
Excellent, Hans said. That's 2 souls, 2 hours to win.
Ah, but you'll need 3 hours to get through the gates on time, won't you?
I'm afraid you can't use Ra. He's not in his right mind. Your mother is already dead. Your father is the judge of the underworld, so he's disqualified from soul wagering.
I'll do it,
Bess said. His face was grim but determined.
Old buddy, Hans cried. I'm delighted.
Stuff it, Moon God, Bess said. I don't like it, but I'll do it.
Bess, I said, you've done enough for us. Bost would never expect you.
I'm not doing it for Bost, he grumbled.
Then he took a deep breath.
Look, you kids are the real deal. Last couple of days, for the first time in ages, I've felt wanted again. Important. Not like a sideshow attraction. If things go wrong, just tell Tawaret.
He cleared his throat and gave Sadie a meaningful look.
Tell her I tried to turn back the clock.
Oh, Bess.
Sadie got up and ran around the table. She hugged the dwarf god and kissed his cheek.
All right, all right, he muttered. Don't go sappy on me. Let's play this game.
Time is money, Hans agreed.
Our parents stood.
We cannot stay for this, Dad said. But, children.
He didn't seem to know how to complete the thought. Good luck probably wouldn't have cut it. I could see the guilt and worry in his eyes, but he was trying hard not to show it.
A good general, Horace would have said.
We love you,
our mother finished.
You will prevail.
With that, our parents turned to mist and vanished. Everything outside the pavilion darkened like a stage set. The Senate game began to glow brighter.
Shiny,
Ra said.
Three blue pieces for you, Hans said. Three silver pieces for me. Now, who's feeling lucky?
The game started well enough. Sadie had skill at tossing the sticks. Bess had several thousand years of gaming experience. And I got the job of moving the pieces and making sure Ra didn't eat them. At first, it wasn't obvious who was winning. We just rolled and moved, and it was hard to believe we were playing for our souls, or true names, or whatever you want to call them. We bumped one of Hans's pieces back to start, but he didn't seem upset. He seemed delighted by just about everything. "Doesn't it bother you?" I asked at one point. "Devouring innocent souls?"
"Not really."
He polished his crescent amulet.
"Why should it?"
"But we're trying to save the world," Sadie said. "Mott, the gods, everything. Don't you care if the world crumbles into chaos?"
"Oh, it wouldn't be so bad," Hans said. "Change comes in phases. Mott and chaos, chaos and Mott. Being the moon god, I appreciate variation. Now, Ra, poor guy. He always stuck to a schedule. Same path every night. So predictable and boring.
Retiring was the most interesting thing he ever did.
If Apophis takes over and swallows the sun, well, I suppose the moon will still be there."
"You're insane," Sadie said.
"Ha! I'll bet you 5 extra minutes of moonlight that I'm perfectly sane."
"Forget it," Sadie said. "Just roll."
Hans tossed the sticks. The bad news? He made alarming progress. He rolled a 5 and got one of his pieces almost to the end of the board. The good news? The piece got stuck at the House of 3 Truths, which meant he could only roll a 3 to get it out. Bess studied the board intently. He didn't seem to like what he saw. We had 1 piece way back at the start and 2 pieces on the last row of the board.
"Careful now," Hans warned. "This is where it gets interesting."
Sadie rolled a 4, which gave us 2 options. Our lead piece could go out, or our second piece could bump Hans's piece from the House of 3 Truths and send it back to start.
"Bump him," I said. "It's safer."
Bess shook his head.
"Then we're stuck in the House of 3 Truths. The chances of him rolling a 3 are slim. Take your first piece out. That way you'll be assured of at least 1 extra hour."
"But 1 extra hour won't do it," Sadie said.
Hans seemed to be enjoying our indecision. He sipped wine from a silvery goblet and smiled. Meanwhile, Ra entertained himself by trying to pick the spikes off his war flail.
"Ow! Ow! Ow!"
My forehead beaded with sweat. How was I sweating in a board game? "Bess, are you sure?
It's your best bet, he said.
Best? Hans chuckled. Nice!
I wanted to smack the moon god, but I kept my mouth shut. I moved our first piece out of play.
Congratulations, Hans said. I owe you 1 hour of moonlight.
Now it's my turn.
He tossed the sticks. They clattered on the dining table, and I felt like someone had snipped an elevator cable in my chest, plunging my heart straight down a shaft. Hans had rolled a 3.
Whoopsie!
Ra dropped his flail. Hans moved his piece out of play.
Oh, what a shame. Now, whose wren do I collect first?
No, please, Sadie said. Trade back. Take the hour you owe us instead.
Those aren't the rules, Hans chided.
I looked down at the gouge I'd made in the table when I was 8. I knew that memory was about to disappear like all my others. If I gave my wren to Hans, at least Sadie could still cast the final part of the spell. She would need Bess to protect her and advise her. I was the only expendable one. I started to say,
Me, said Bess. The move was my idea.
Bess, no!
Sadie cried. The dwarf stood. He planted his feet and balled his fists, like he was getting ready to let loose with a boo. I wished he'd do that and scare away Hans, but instead he looked at us with resignation.
It was part of the strategy, kids.
What? I asked. You planned this? He slipped off his Hawaiian shirt and folded it carefully, setting it on the table.
Most important thing is getting all 3 of your pieces off the board, and losing no more than 1. This was the only way to do it. You'll beat him easily now. Sometimes you have to lose a piece to win a game.
So true, Hans said. What a delight, a god's wren. Are you ready, Bess?
Bess, don't, I pleaded. This isn't right. He scowled at me.
Hey, kid, you were willing to sacrifice. Are you saying I'm not as brave as some pipsqueak magician? Besides, I'm a god. Who knows? Sometimes we come back. Now, win the game and get out of here. Kick Menshikov in the knee for me.
I tried to think of something to say, something that would stop this, but Bess said,
I'm ready.
Hans closed his eyes and inhaled deeply, like he was enjoying some fresh mountain air. Bess's form flickered. He dissolved into a montage of lightning-fast images, a troop of dwarves dancing at a temple in the firelight, a crowd of Egyptians partying at a festival, carrying Bess and Bast on their shoulders, Bess and Tawaret in togas at some Roman villa, eating grapes and laughing together on a sofa. Bess, dressed like George Washington in a powdered wig and silk suit, doing cartwheels in front of some British redcoats. Bess, in the olive fatigues of a U.S. Marine, scaring away a demon in a World War II Nazi uniform. As his silhouette melted, more recent images flickered past. Bess in a chauffeur's uniform with a placard that read Cain. Bess pulling us out of our sinking limo in the Mediterranean. Bess casting spells on me in Alexandria when I was poisoned, trying desperately to heal me. Bess and me in the back of the Bedouin's pickup truck, sharing goat meat and Vaseline-flavored water as we traveled along the bank of the Nile. His last memory? 2 kids, Sadie and me, looking at him with love and concern. Then the image faded. And Bess was gone. Even his Hawaiian shirt had disappeared.
You took all of him, I yelled. His body, everything! That wasn't the deal!
Hans opened his eyes and sighed deeply.
That was lovely.
He smiled at us as if nothing had happened.
I believe it's your turn.
His silver eyes were cold and luminous, and I had a feeling that for the rest of my life I would hate looking at the moon. Maybe it was rage, or Bess's strategy, or maybe we just got lucky, but the rest of the game, Sadie and I destroyed Hans easily. We bumped his pieces at every opportunity. Within 5 minutes, our last piece was off the board. Hans spread his hands.
Well done! 3 hours are yours. If you hurry, you can make the gates of the 8th house.
I hate you,
Sadie said. It was the first she'd spoken since Bess disappeared.
You're cold, calculating, horrible, and I'm just what you needed.
Hans took off his platinum Rolex and wound back the time. 1, 2, 3 hours. All around us, the statues of the gods flickered and jumped like the world was being slammed into reverse.
Now, Hans said, would you like to spend your hard-earned time complaining? Or do you want to save this poor old fool of a king?
Zebras?
Ra muttered hopefully. Where are our parents? I asked. At least let us say goodbye. Hans shook his head.
Time is precious, Carter Kane. You should have learned that lesson. It's best that I send you on your way. But if you ever want to gamble with me again, for seconds, hours, even days, just let me know. Your credit is good.
I couldn't stand it. I lunged at Hans, but the moon god vanished. The whole pavilion faded, and Sadie and I were standing on the deck of the sunboat again, sailing down the dark river. The glowing crew lights buzzed around us, manning the oars and trimming the sail. Ra sat on his fiery throne, playing with his crook and flail like they were puppets having an imaginary conversation. In front of us, a pair of enormous stone gates loomed out of the darkness. 8 massive snakes were carved into the rock, 4 on each side. The gates were slowly closing, but the sunboat slipped through just in time, and we passed into the 8th house. I have to say, the House of Challenges didn't seem very challenging. We fought monsters, yes. Serpents loomed out of the river. Demons arose. Ships full of ghosts tried to board the sunboat. We destroyed them all. I was so angry, so devastated at losing Bess, that I imagined every threat was the moon god Hans. Our enemies didn't stand a chance. Sadie cast spells I'd never seen her use. She summoned sheets of ice that probably matched her emotions, leaving several demon icebergs in our wake. She turned an entire ship full of pirate ghosts into Hans bobbleheads, then vaporized them in a miniature nuclear explosion. Meanwhile, Ra played happily with his toys while the light servants flittered around the deck in agitation, apparently sensing that our journey was reaching a critical phase. The 9th, 10th, and 11th houses passed in a blur. From time to time I heard a splash in the water behind us, like the oar of another boat. I looked back, wondering if Menshikov had somehow gotten on our tail again, but I didn't see anything. If something was following us, it knew better than to show itself. At last I heard a roar up ahead, like another waterfall or a stretch of rapids. The light orbs worked furiously, taking down the sail, pushing on the oars, but we kept gaining speed. We passed under a low archway carved like the goddess Nut, her starry limbs stretched out protectively and her face smiling in welcome. I got the feeling that we were entering the 12th house, the last part of the Duat before we emerged into a new dawn. I hoped to see light at the end of the tunnel, literally, but instead our path had been sabotaged. I could see where the river was supposed to go. The tunnel continued ahead, slowly winding out of the Duat. I could even smell fresh air, the scent of the mortal world. But the far end of the tunnel had been drained to a field of mud. In front of us, the river plunged into a massive pit, like an asteroid had punched a hole in the earth and diverted the water straight down. We were racing toward the drop.
"We could jump," Sadie said. "Abandon ship."
But I think we came to the same conclusion. We needed the sunboat. We needed Ra. We had to follow the course of the river wherever it led.
"It's a trap," Sadie said. "The work of Apophis."
"I know," I said. "Let's go tell him we don't like his work." We both grabbed the mast as the ship plunged into the maelstrom. It seemed like we fell forever. You know the feeling when you dive to the bottom of a deep pool, like your nose and ears are going to explode, and your eyes are going to pop out of your head? Imagine that feeling 100 times worse. We were sinking into the Duat deeper than we'd ever been. Deeper than any mortal was supposed to go. The molecules of my body felt like they were heating up, buzzing so fast they might fly apart. We didn't crash. We didn't hit bottom. The boat simply flipped direction, like down had become sideways, and we sailed into a cavern that glowed with harsh red light. The magical pressure was so intense that my ears rang. I was nauseated, and I could barely think straight, but I recognized the shoreline up ahead. A beach, made of millions of dead scarab shells, shifting and surging as a force underneath, a massive serpentine shape, struggled to break free. Dozens of demons were digging through the scarab shells with shovels, and standing on the shore, waiting for us patiently, was Vlad Menshikov, his clothes charred and smoking, his staff glowing with green fire.
"Welcome, children," he called across the water. "Come, join me for the end of the world."
22. Friends in the Strangest Places. Menshikov looked like he'd swum through the lake of fire without a magic shield. His curly gray hair had been reduced to black stubble. His white suit was shredded and peppered with burn holes. His whole face was blistered, so his ruined eyes didn't seem out of place. As Bess might have said, Menshikov was wearing his ugly outfit. The memory of Bess made me angry. Everything we'd gone through, everything we'd lost, was all Vlad Menshikov's fault. The sunboat ground to a halt on the scarab shell beach. Ra warbled, "Hello!" and stumbled to his feet. He began chasing a blue servant orb around the deck as if it were a pretty butterfly. The demons dropped their shovels and assembled on the shore. They looked at each other uncertainly, no doubt wondering if this were some sort of clever trick. Surely this doddering old fool could not be the sun god.
"Wonderful," Menshikov said. "You brought Ra after all."
It took me a moment to realize what was different about his voice. The gravelly breathing was gone. His tone was a deep, smooth baritone.
"I was worried," he continued. "You took so long in the fourth house, I thought you'd be trapped for the night. We could have freed Lord Apophis without you, of course, but it would have been so inconvenient to hunt you down later. This is much better. Lord Apophis will be hungry when he wakes. He'll be most pleased that you brought him a snack."
"Whee! Snack!"
Ra giggled. He hobbled around the boat, trying to smash the servant light with his flail. The demons began to laugh. Menshikov gave them an indulgent smile.
"Yes, quite amusing," he said. "My grandfather entertained Peter the Great with a dwarf wedding. I will do even better. I will entertain the Lord of Chaos himself with a senile sun god."
The voice of Horus spoke urgently in my mind. "Take back the weapons of the Pharaoh. This is your last chance." Deep inside, I knew it was a bad idea. If I claimed the weapons of the Pharaoh now, I'd never return them. And the powers I'd gain wouldn't be enough to defeat Apophis. Still, I was tempted. It would feel so good to grab the crook and flail from that stupid old god Ra and smash Menshikov into the ground. The Russian's eyes glittered with malice.
"A rematch, Carter Kane. By all means. I notice you don't have your dwarf babysitter this time. Let's see what you can do on your own."
My vision turned red, and it had nothing to do with the light in the cavern. I stepped off the boat and summoned the Hawk God's avatar. I'd never tried the spell so deep in the Duat before. I got more than I asked for. Instead of being encased in a glowing holograph, I felt myself growing, taller, and stronger. My eyesight grew sharper. Sadie made a strangled sound.
"Carter? Large bird," Ra said.
I looked down and found I was a flesh-and-blood giant, 15 feet tall, dressed in the battle armor of Horus. I brought my enormous hands to my head and patted feathers instead of hair. My mouth was a razor-sharp beak. I shouted with elation, and it came out as a screech, echoing through the cavern. The demons scrambled back nervously.
I looked down at Menshikov, who now seemed as insignificant as a mouse. I was ready to pulverize him. But Menshikov sneered and pointed his staff. Whatever he was planning, Sadie was faster. She threw down her own staff, and it transformed into a kite, the bird of prey kind, as large as a pterodactyl. Typical. I pull something really cool, like morphing into a hawk warrior, and Sadie has to show me up. Her kite buffeted the air with its massive wings. Menshikov and his demons went somersaulting backward across the beach.
Two large birds!
Ra started to clap.
Carter, guard me!
Sadie pulled out the Book of Ra.
I need to start the spell.
I thought the giant kite was doing a pretty good job with guard duty, but I stepped forward and got ready to fight. Menshikov rose to his feet.
By all means, Sadie Kane, start your little spell. Don't you understand? The spirit of Khepri created this prison. Ra gave part of his own soul, his ability to be reborn, to keep Apophis chained.
Sadie looked like he'd slapped her in the face.
The lost scarab.
Exactly.
Menshikov agreed.
All these scarabs were multiplied from one. Khepri, the third soul of Ra. My demons will find it eventually. Digging through the shells. It's one of the only scarabs still alive now, and once we crush it, Apophis will be free. Even if you summon it back to Ra, Apophis will still be freed. Either way, Ra is too weak to fight. Apophis will devour him, as the ancient prophecies predicted, and chaos will destroy Mott once and for all. You can't win.
You're insane, I said, my voice much deeper than usual.
You'll be destroyed, too.
I saw the fractured light in his eyes, and I realized something that shocked me to the core. Menshikov didn't want this any more than we did. He'd lived with grief and despair so long that Apophis had twisted his soul, made him a prisoner of his own hateful feelings. Vladimir Menshikov pretended to gloat, but he didn't feel any sense of triumph. Inside, he was terrified, defeated, miserable. He was enslaved by Apophis. I almost felt sorry for him.
We're already dead, Carter Kane, he said. This place was never meant for humans. Don't you feel it? The power of chaos is seeping into our bodies, withering our souls. But I have bigger plans. A host can live indefinitely, no matter what sickness he may have, no matter how injured he may be. Apophis has already healed my voice. Soon I will be whole again. I will live forever.
A host? When I realized what he meant, I almost lost control of my new giant form.
You're not serious, Menshikov. Stop this, before it's too late.
And die?
He asked. Behind me, a new voice said,
There are worse things than death, Vladimir.
I turned and saw a second boat gliding toward the shore. A small gray skiff with a single magic oar that rowed itself. The Eye of Horus was painted on the boat's prow, and its lone passenger was Michel Desjardins. The chief lector's hair and beard were now white as snow. Glowing hieroglyphs floated from his cream-colored robes, making a trail of divine words behind him. Desjardins stepped ashore.
You toy with something much worse than death, my old friend. Pray that I kill you before you succeed.
Of all the weird things I'd experienced that night, Desjardins stepping up to fight on our side was definitely the weirdest. He walked between my giant hawk warrior and Sadie's mega kite like they were no big deal, and planted his staff in the dead scarabs.
Surrender, Vladimir!
Menshikov laughed.
Have you looked at yourself lately, my lord? My curses have been sapping your strength for months, and you didn't even realize it. You're nearly dead now. I am the most powerful magician in the world.
It was true that Desjardins didn't look good.
His face was almost as gaunt and wrinkled as the sun god's, but the cloud of hieroglyphs seemed stronger around him. His eyes blazed with intensity, just as they had months ago in New Mexico, when he'd battled us in the streets of Las Cruces and vowed to destroy us. He took another step forward, and the mob of demons edged away. I suppose they recognized the leopard-skin cape around his shoulders as a mark of power.
"I have failed in many things," Desjardins admitted. "But I will not fail in this. I will not let you destroy the House of Life."
"The House?"
Menshikov's voice turned shrill.
"It died centuries ago. It should have been disbanded when Egypt fell."
He kicked at the dried scarab shells.
"The house has as much life as these hollow bug husks. Wake up, Michel. Egypt is gone. Meaningless, ancient history. It's time to destroy the world and start anew. Chaos always wins."
"Not always."
Desjardins turned to Sadie.
"Begin your spell. I will deal with this wretch."
The ground surged under us, trembling as Apophis tried to rise.
"Think fast, children,"
Menshikov warned.
"The world will end no matter what you do. Mortals can't leave this cavern alive, but the two of you have been godlings. Combine with Horus and Isis again. Pledge to serve Apophis, and you could survive this night. Desjardins has always been your enemy. Slay him for me now and present his body as a gift to Apophis. I will assure you both positions of honor in a new world ruled by chaos, unrestricted by any rules. I can even give you the secret of curing Walt Stone."
He smiled at Sadie's stunned expression.
"Yes, my girl, I do know how. The remedy was passed down for generations among the priests of Amun-Ra. Kill Desjardins, join Apophis, and the boy you love will be spared."
I'll be honest. His words were persuasive. I could imagine a new world where anything was possible, where no laws applied, not even the laws of physics, and we could be anything we wanted. Chaos is impatient. It's random. And above all, it's selfish. It tears down everything just for the sake of change, feeding on itself in constant hunger. But chaos can also be appealing. It tempts you to believe that nothing matters except what you want. And there was so much that I wanted. Menshikov's restored voice was smooth and confident, like Amos's tone whenever he used magic to persuade mortals. That was the problem. Menshikov's promise was a trick. His words weren't even his own. They were being forced out of him. His eyes moved like they were reading a teleprompter. He spoke the will of Apophis, but when he finished, he locked eyes with me, and just briefly, I saw his real thoughts. A tortured plea he would have screamed if he had control of his own mouth. "Kill me now, please." "I'm sorry, Menshikov," I said, and I sincerely meant it. "Magicians and gods have to stand together. The world may need fixing, but it's worth preserving. We won't let chaos win." Then a lot of things happened at once. Sadie opened her scroll and began to read. Menshikov screamed, "Attack!" And the demons rushed forward. The giant kite spread its wings, deflecting a blast of green fire from Menshikov's staff that probably would have incinerated Sadie on the spot. I charged to protect her, while Desjardins summoned a whirlwind around his body and flew toward Vlad Menshikov. I waded through demons. I knocked over one with a razor blade head, grabbed his ankles, and swung him around like a weapon, slicing his allies into piles of sand. Sadie's giant kite picked up two more in its claws and tossed them into the river. Meanwhile, Desjardins and Menshikov rose into the air, locked inside a tornado. They whirled around each other, firing blasts of fire, poison, and acid. Demons who got too close melted instantly. In the midst of all this, Sadie read from the Book of Ra. I didn't know how she could concentrate, but her words rang out clear and loud. She invoked the dawn and the rise of a new day. Golden mist began to spread around her feet, weaving through the dried shells as if searching for life. The entire beach shuddered, and far underground, Apophis roared in outrage.
"Oh, noes!" Ra yelled behind me. "Vegetables!"
I turned and saw one of the largest demons boarding the sunboat, wicked knives in all four of his hands. Ra gave him the raspberry and scampered away, hiding behind his fiery throne. I threw Razorblade Head into a crowd of his friends, grabbed a spear from another demon, and threw it toward the boat. If it had just been me throwing, my complete lack of long shot skills might have caused me to impale the sun god, which would have been pretty embarrassing. Fortunately, my new giant form had aim worthy of Horus. The spear hit the forearm demon square in the back. He dropped his knives, staggered to the edge of the boat, and fell into the River of Night. Ra leaned over the side and gave him one last raspberry for good measure. Desjardins' tornado still spun him around, locked in combat with Menshikoff. I couldn't tell which magician had the upper hand. Sadie's kite was doing its best to protect her, impaling demons with its beak and crushing them in its huge claws. Somehow, Sadie kept her concentration. The golden mist thickened as it spread over the beach. The remaining demons began to pull back as Sadie spoke the last words of her spell.
"Khepri, the scarab who rises from death, the rebirth of Ra!"
The Book of Ra vanished in a flash. The ground rumbled, and from the mass of dead shells, a single scarab rose into the air, a living golden beetle that floated toward Sadie and came to rest in her hands. Sadie smiled triumphantly. I almost dared to hope we'd won. Then hissing laughter filled the cavern. Desjardins lost control of his whirlwind, and the chief lector went flying toward the sunboat, slamming into the prow so hard he broke the rail and lay absolutely still. Vladimir Menshikoff dropped to the ground, landing in a crouch. Around his feet, the dead scarab shells dissolved, turning into blood-red sand.
"Brilliant," he said. "Brilliant, Sadie Kane."
He stood, and all the magical energy in the cavern seemed to race toward his body. Golden mist, red light, glowing hieroglyphs, all of it collapsing into Menshikoff as if he'd taken on the gravity of a black hole. His ruined eyes healed. His blistered face became smooth, young, and handsome. His white suit mended itself, then the fabric turned dark red. His skin rippled, and I realized with a chill that he was growing snake scales. On the sunboat, Ra muttered,
"Oh, noes! Need zebras!"
The entire beach turned to red sand. Menshikoff held out his hand to my sister.
"Give me the scarab, Sadie. I will have mercy on you. You and your brother will live. Walt will live."
Sadie clutched the scarab. I got ready to charge. Even in the body of a giant hawk warrior, I could feel the chaos energy getting stronger and stronger, sapping my strength. Menshikoff had warned us that no mortal could survive this cavern, and I believed him. We didn't have much time, but we had to stop Apophis. In the back of my mind, I accepted the fact that I would die. I was acting now for the sake of our friends, for the Kane family, for the whole mortal world.
"You want the scarab, Apophis?"
Sadie's voice was full of loathing.
"Then come and get it, you disgusting—"
She called Apophis some words so bad, Gran would have washed her mouth out with soap for a year. And no, Sadie, I'm not going to say them into the microphone. Menshikoff stepped toward her. I picked up a shovel one of the demons had dropped. Sadie's giant kite flew at Menshikoff, its talons poised to strike, but Menshikoff flicked his hand like he was shooing away a fly. The monster dissolved into a cloud of feathers.
"Do you take me for a god?"
Menshikoff roared. As he focused on Sadie, I skirted behind him, doing my best to sneak closer, which is not easy when you're a 15-foot-tall birdman.
I am chaos itself! Menshikov bellowed. I will unknit your bones, dissolve your soul, and send you back to the primordial ooze you came from. Now, give me the scarab!
Tempting, Sadie said. What do you think, Carter? Menshikov realized the trap too late. I lunged forward and hit him upside the head with the shovel. Menshikov crumpled. I body slammed him into the sand, then stood up and stomped him in a little deeper. I buried him as best I could. Then Sadie pointed at his burial site and spoke the glyph for fire. The sand melted, hardening into a coffin-sized block of solid glass. I would have spit on it, too, but I wasn't sure I could do that with a falcon beak. The surviving demons did the sensible thing. They fled in panic. A few jumped into the river and let themselves dissolve, which was a real time-saver for us. That wasn't so hard, Sadie said, though I could tell the chaos energy was starting to wear her down, too. Even when she was 5 and had pneumonia, I don't think she looked this bad. Hurry, I said. My adrenaline was fading quickly. My avatar form was starting to feel like an extra 500 pounds of dead weight. Get the scarab to Ra. She nodded and ran toward the sunboat. But she'd only made it halfway when Menshikov's glass grave blew up. The most powerful explosive magic I'd ever seen was Sadie's Hadi spell. This blast was about 50 times more powerful. A high-powered wave of sand and glass shards knocked me off my feet and shredded my avatar. Back in my regular body, blind and in pain, I crawled away from the laughing voice of Apophis.
Where did you go, Sadie Kane?
Apophis called, his voice now as deep as a cannon shot.
Where is that bad little girl with my scarab?
I blinked the sand out of my eyes. Vlad Menshikov, no, he might look like Vlad, but he was Apophis now, was about 50 feet away, stalking around the rim of the crater he'd made in the beach. He either didn't see me or he assumed I was dead. He was looking for Sadie, but she was nowhere. The blast must have buried her in the sand, or worse. My throat closed up. I wanted to get to my feet and tackle Apophis, but my body wouldn't work. My magic was depleted. The power of chaos was sapping my life force. Just from being near Apophis, I felt like I was coming undone. My brain synapses, my DNA, everything that made me Carter Kane was slowly dissolving. Finally, Apophis spread his arms.
No matter. I'll dig your body up later. First, I'll deal with the old man.
For a second, I thought he meant Desjardins, who was still crumpled lifelessly over the broken railing, but Apophis climbed into the boat, ignoring the chief lector, and approached the throne of fire.
Hello, Ra, he said in a kindly voice. It's been a long time.
A feeble voice from behind the chair said, Can't play. Go away.
Would you like a treat?
Apophis asked.
We used to play so nicely together. Every night trying to kill each other. Don't you remember?
Ra poked his bald head above the throne.
Treat?
How about a stuffed date?
Apophis pulled one out of the air.
You used to love stuffed dates, didn't you? All you have to do is come out and let me devour... I mean, entertain you.
Want a cookie,
Ra said.
What kind?
Weasel cookie.
I'm here to tell you that comment about weasel cookies probably saved the known universe. Apophis stepped back, obviously confused by a comment that was even more chaotic than he was. And in that moment, Michel Desjardins struck. The chief lector must have been playing dead, or maybe he just recovered quickly. He rose up and launched himself at Apophis, slamming him against the burning throne. Menshikov screamed in his old, raspy voice. Steam hissed like water on a barbecue. Desjardins' robes caught fire. Ra scrambled to the back of the boat and poked his crook in the air like that would make the bad men go away. I struggled to my feet, but I still felt like I was carrying a few hundred extra pounds. Menshikov and Desjardins grappled with each other in front of the throne. This was the scene I'd witnessed in the Hall of Ages, the first moment in a new age. I knew I should help, but I scrambled along the beach, trying to gauge the spot where I'd last seen Sadie. I fell to my knees and started to dig. Desjardins and Menshikov struggled back and forth, shouting out words of power. I glanced over and saw a cloud of hieroglyphs and red lights swirling around them as the chief lector summoned Mott, and Apophis just as quickly dissolved his spells with chaos. As for Ra, the almighty sun god, he had scrambled to the stern of the boat and was cowering under the tiller. I kept digging. "Sadie," I muttered, "come on, where are you?" "Think," I told myself. I closed my eyes. I thought about Sadie, every memory we'd shared since Christmas. We'd lived apart for years. But over the last 3 months, I'd become closer to her than anyone else in the world. If she could figure out my secret name while I was unconscious, surely I could find her in a pile of sand. I scrambled a few feet to the left and began to dig again. Immediately, I scratched Sadie's nose. She groaned, which at least meant she was alive. I brushed off her face and she coughed. Then she raised her arms and I pulled her out of the sand. I was so relieved I almost sobbed. But being a macho guy and all, I didn't. "Shut up, Sadie, I'm telling this part." Apophis and Desjardins were still fighting back and forth on the sunboat. Desjardins yelled, "Hesha!" and a hieroglyph blazed between them. Apophis went flying off the boat like he'd been hooked by a moving train. He sailed right over us and landed in the sand about 40 feet away. "Nice one," Sadie muttered in a daze. "Glyph a turn back." Desjardins staggered off the sunboat. His robes were still smoldering, but from his sleeve he pulled a ceramic statuette, a red snake carved with hieroglyphs. Sadie gasped. "A shabti of Apophis! The penalty for making those is death!" I could understand why. Images had power. In the wrong hands, they could strengthen or even summon the being they represented, and a statue of Apophis was way too dangerous to play with. But it was also a necessary ingredient for certain spells. "An execration," I said. "He's trying to erase Apophis." "That's impossible," Sadie said. "He'll be destroyed." Desjardins began to chant. Hieroglyphs glowed in the air around him, swirling into a cone of protective power. Sadie tried to get to her feet, but she wasn't in much better shape than I was. Apophis sat up. His face was a nightmare of burns from the Throne of Fire. He looked like a half-cooked hamburger patty someone had dropped in the sand. Sadie says that's too gross. Well, I'm sorry, it's accurate. When he saw the statue in the chief lector's hands, he roared in outrage.
"Are you insane, Michel? You can't execrate me."
"Apophis," Desjardins chanted. "I name you Lord of Chaos, Serpent in the Dark, Fear of the 12 Houses, the Hated One."
"Stop it!" Apophis bellowed. "I cannot be contained."
He shot a blast of fire at Desjardins, but the energy simply joined the swirling cloud around the chief lector, turning into the hieroglyph for heat. Desjardins stumbled forward, aging before our eyes, becoming more stooped and frail, but his voice remained strong.
"I speak for the gods. I speak for the House of Life. I am a servant of Mott. I cast you underfoot."
Desjardins threw down the red snake, and Apophis fell to his side. The Lord of Chaos hurled everything he had at Desjardins. Ice, poison, lightning, boulders, but nothing connected. They all simply turned into hieroglyphs in the chief lector's shield. Chaos forced into patterns of words, into the divine language of creation. Desjardins smashed the ceramic snake under his foot. Apophis writhed in agony. The thing that used to be Vladimir Menshikov crumbled like a wax shell, and a creature rose out of it. A red snake, covered in slime like a new hatchling. It began to grow, its red scales glistening and its eyes glowing. Its voice hissed in my mind.
I cannot be contained.
But it was having trouble rising. The sand churned around it. A portal was opening, anchored on Apophis himself.
I erase your name, Desjardins said. I remove you from the memory of Egypt.
Apophis screamed. The beach imploded around him, swallowing the serpent and sucking the red sand into the vortex. I grabbed Sadie and ran for the boat. Desjardins had collapsed to his knees in exhaustion, but somehow I managed to hook his arm and drag him to the shore. Together, Sadie and I hauled him aboard the sunboat. Ra finally scrambled out from his hiding place under the tiller. The glowing servant lights manned the oars, and we pulled away as the entire beach sank into the dark waters, flashes of red lightning rippling under the surface. Desjardins was dying. The hieroglyphs had faded around him. His forehead was burning hot. His skin was as dry and thin as rice paper, and his voice was a ragged whisper.
Execration won't last, he warned. Only bought you some time.
I gripped his hand like he was an old friend, not a former enemy. After playing Senate with the Moon God, buying time wasn't something I took lightly. Why did you do it? I asked. You used all your life force to banish him. Desjardins smiled faintly.
Don't like you much, but you were right. The old ways, our only chance. Tell Amos what happened.
He clawed feebly at his leopard-skin cape, and I realized he wanted to remove it. I helped him, and he pressed the cape into my hands.
Show this to the others. Tell Amos.
His eyes rolled into his head, and the chief lector passed. His body disintegrated into hieroglyphs. Too many to read, the story of his entire life. Then the words floated away down the river of night.
Bye-bye,
Ra muttered.
Weasels are sick.
I'd almost forgotten about the old god. He slumped in his throne again, resting his head on the loop of his crook and swatting his flail half-heartedly at the servant lights. Sadie took a shaky breath.
Desjardins saved us. I didn't like him either, but...
I know, I said. But we have to keep going. Do you still have the scarab? Sadie pulled the wriggling golden scarab from her pocket. Together, we approached Ra. Take it, I told him. Ra wrinkled his already wrinkled nose.
Don't want a bug. It's your soul, Sadie snapped. You'll take it, and you'll like it.
Ra looked cowed. He took the beetle, and to my horror, popped it in his mouth.
No!
Sadie yelped. Too late. Ra had swallowed.
Oh, God, Sadie said. Was he supposed to do that? Maybe he was supposed to do that. Don't like bugs,
Ra muttered. We waited for him to change into a powerful, youthful king. Instead, he burped. He stayed old and weird and disgusting. In a daze, I walked with Sadie back to the front of the ship. We'd done everything we could, and yet I felt like we'd lost. As we sailed on, the magic pressure seemed to ease. The river appeared level, but I could sense we were rising rapidly through the Duat. Despite that, I still felt like my insides were melting. Sadie didn't look any better. Menshikov's words echoed in my head.
Mortals can't leave this cavern alive.
It's chaos sickness, Sadie said. We're not going to make it, are we?
We have to hold on, I said, at least until dawn.
All that, Sadie said. And what happened?
We retrieved a senile god. We lost Bess and the chief lector. And we're dying.
I took Sadie's hand.
Maybe not. Look.
Ahead of us, the tunnel was getting brighter. The cavern walls dissolved, and the river widened. Two pillars rose from the water, two giant golden scarab statues. Beyond them gleamed the morning skyline of Manhattan. The River of Night was emptying out into New York Harbor.
Each new dawn is a new world, I remembered our dad saying. Maybe we'll be healed.
Ra, too? Sadie asked.
I didn't have an answer, but I was starting to feel better, stronger, like I'd had a good night's sleep. As we passed between the golden scarab statues, I looked to our right. Across the water, smoke was rising from Brooklyn. Flashes of multicolored light and streaks of fire as winged creatures engaged in aerial combat.
They're still alive, Sadie said. They need help.
We turned the sunboat toward home and sailed straight into battle.
23. We throw a wild house party. Fatal mistake, Carter, giving me the microphone at the most important part. You'll never get it back now. The end of the story is mine. Oh, that felt good. I'd be excellent at world domination. But I digress. You might have seen news reports about the strange double sunrise over Brooklyn on the morning of March 21st. There were many theories. Haze in the air from pollution, a temperature drop in the lower atmosphere, aliens, or perhaps another sewer gas leak causing mass hysteria. We love sewer gas in Brooklyn. I can confirm, however, that there briefly were two suns in the sky. I know this because I was in one of them. The normal sun rose as usual, but there was also the boat of Ra, blazing as it rose from the Duat, out of New York Harbor and into the sky of the mortal world. To observers below, the second sun appeared to merge with the light of the first. What actually happened? The sunboat dimmed as it descended toward Brooklyn House, where the mansion's anti-mortal camouflage shielding enveloped it and made it seem to disappear. The shielding was already working overtime as a full-fledged war was in progress. Freak the Griffin was diving through the air, engaging the winged flaming snakes, the Uri, in aerial combat. I know that's a horrible word to pronounce, Uri, but Carter insists it's the plural for Urias, and there's no arguing with him. Just say you're right, and leave off the T, and you've got it. Freak yelled, "Freak!" and gobbled up a Urias, but he was sorely outnumbered. His fur was singed, and his buzzing wings must have been damaged as he kept spinning in circles like a broken helicopter. His rooftop nest was on fire. Our portal sphinx was broken, and the chimney was stained with a massive black starburst where something or someone had exploded. A squad of enemy magicians and demons had taken cover behind the air conditioning unit and were pinned in combat against Zia and Walt, who were guarding the stairwell. Both sides threw fire, sharpty, and glowing hieroglyphic bombs across the no man's land of the roof. As we descended over the enemy, old Ra, yes, he was still just as senile and withered as ever, leaned over the side and waved at everyone with his crook. "Hello, zebras!" Both sides looked up in amazement. "Ra!" one demon screamed. Then everyone took up the cry. "Ra! Ra! Ra!" They sounded like the world's most terrified pep squad. The Uri stopped spitting fire, much to Freak's surprise, and immediately flew to the sunboat. They began circling us like an honor guard, and I remembered what Menshikov had said about them originally being creatures of Ra. Apparently they recognized their old master. Emphasis on old. Most of the enemies below us scattered as the boat came down, but the slowest of the demons said, "Ra?" and looked up just as our sunboat landed on top of him with a satisfying crunch. Carter and I jumped into battle. In spite of all we'd been through, I felt wonderful. The chaos chaos sickness had disappeared as soon as we'd risen from the Duat. My magic was strong, my spirits were high. If I'd just had a shower, some fresh clothes, and a proper cup of tea, I would have been in paradise. Strike that. Now that I'd seen paradise, I didn't much like it. I'd settle for my own room. I zapped one demon into a tiger and unleashed him on his brethren. Carter popped into avatar form, the glowing golden kind, thank goodness. The 3-meter-tall bird man had been a bit too scary for me. He smashed his way through the terrified enemy magicians and with a sweep of his hand sent them sailing into the East River. Zia and Walt came out from the stairwell and helped us mop up the stragglers. Then they ran to us with big grins on their faces. They looked battered and bruised, but still very much alive. Freak! Said the Griffin. He swooped down and landed next to Carter, headbutting his combat avatar, which I hoped was a sign of affection. Hey, buddy, Carter rubbed his head, careful to avoid the monster's chainsaw wings. What's happening, guys?
Talking didn't work, Zia said dryly. The enemy's been trying to break in all night, Walt said. Amos and Bast have held them off, but...
He glanced at the sunboat, and his voice faltered.
Is that... That isn't...
Zebra! Ra called, tottering toward us with a big, toothless grin. He walked straight up to Zia and pulled something out of his mouth. The glowing gold scarab, now quite wet but undigested. He offered it to her.
I like zebras.
Zia backed up.
This is Ra, the Lord of the Sun? Why is he offering me a bug?
And what does he mean about zebras? Walt asked. Ra looked at Walt and clucked disapprovingly.
Weasels are sick.
Suddenly a chill went through me. My head spun as if the chaos sickness was returning. In the back of my mind, an idea started to form. Something very important. Zebras. Zia, weasels, Walt. Before I could think about this further, a large boom shook the building. Chunks of limestone flew from the side of the mansion and rained down on the warehouse yard. They've breached the walls again, Walt said. Hurry! I consider myself fairly scattered and hyper, but the rest of the battle happened too fast even for me to keep track of. Ra absolutely refused to be parted from Zebra and Weasel, sorry, Zia and Walt, so we left him in their care at the sunboat while Freak lowered Carter and me to the deck below. We dropped from his claws onto the buffet table and found Bast whirling around with her knives in hand, slicing demons to sand and kicking magicians into the swimming pool, where our albino crocodile, Philip of Macedonia, was only too happy to entertain them.
Sadie, she cried with relief.
Yes, Carter, she called my name instead of yours, but she's known me longer, after all. She seemed to be having a great deal of fun, but her tone was urgent. They've breached the east wall. Get inside. We ran through the doorway, dodging a random wombat that went flying over our heads, possibly someone's spell gone awry, and stepped into complete pandemonium.
Holy horrors, Carter said.
In fact, Horus was about the only thing not doing battle in the Great Room. Hufu, our intrepid baboon, was riding an old magician around the room, choking him with his own wand and steering him into walls as the mage turned blue. Felix had unleashed a squad of penguins on another magician, who cowered in a magic circle with some sort of post-traumatic stress, screaming, "Not Antarctica again! Anything but that!" Alyssa was summoning the powers of Geb to repair a massive hole the enemy had blasted in the far wall. Julian had summoned a combat avatar for the first time and was slicing demons with his glowing sword. Even bookish Cleo was dashing about the room, pulling scrolls from her pouch and reading random words of power like blind, horizontal, and gassy, which, by the way, work wonders to incapacitate an enemy. Everywhere I looked, our initiates were ruling the day. They fought as if they'd been waiting all night for the chance to strike, which I suppose was exactly the case. And there was Jazz! Jazz! Up
and looking quite healthy, knocking an enemy's shabti straight into the fireplace, where it broke into 1,000 pieces. I felt an overwhelming sense of pride, and not a small amount of amazement. I'd been so worried about our young trainees surviving, yet they were quite simply dominating a much more seasoned group of magicians. Most impressive, though, was Amos. I'd seen him do magic, but never like this. He stood at the base of Toth's statue, swirling his staff and summoning lightning and thunder, blasting enemy magicians and flinging them away in miniature storm clouds. A woman magician charged at him, her staff glowing with red flames, but Amos simply tapped the floor. The marble tiles turned to sand at her feet, and the woman sank up to her neck. Carter and I looked at each other, grinned, and joined the fight. It was a complete rout. Soon the demons had been reduced to sand piles, and the enemy magicians began scattering in panic. No doubt they'd been expecting to fight a band of untrained children. They hadn't counted on the full cane treatment. One of the women managed to open a portal in the far wall. "Stop them," the voice of Isis spoke in my mind, which was quite a shock after such a long silence. "They must hear the truth." I don't know where I got the idea, but I raised my arms and shimmering rainbow wings appeared on either side of me, the wings of Isis. I swept my arms. A blast of wind and multicolored light knocked our enemies off their feet, leaving our friends perfectly unharmed. "Listen," I bellowed. Everyone fell silent. My voice normally sounds bossy, but now it seemed magnified by a factor of 10. The wings probably commanded attention as well. "We're not your enemies," I said. "I don't care if you like us, but the world has changed. You need to hear what's happened." My magic wings faded as I told everyone about our trip through the Duat, Ra's rebirth, Menshikov's betrayal, the rising of Apophis, and Desjardins' sacrifice to banish the serpent. "Lice!" An Asian man in charred blue robes stepped forward. From the vision Carter had described, I supposed that he was Kwai. "It's true," Carter said. His avatar no longer surrounded him. His clothes had reverted to the normal mortal ones we'd bought him in Cairo, but somehow he still looked quite imposing, quite confident. He held up the leopard-skin cape of the chief lector, and I could feel a ripple of shock spread through the room. "Desjardins fought at our side," Carter said. "He defeated Menshikov and execrated Apophis. He sacrificed his life to buy us a little time. But Apophis will be back. Desjardins wanted you to know. With his last words, he told me to show you this cape and explain the truth. Especially you, Amos. He wanted you to know. The path of gods has to be restored." The enemy's escape portal was still swirling. No one had stepped through yet. The woman who'd summoned it spit on our floor. She had white robes and spiky black hair. She shouted to her comrades, "What are you waiting for? They bring us the chief lector's cape and tell us this crazy story. They're Cains, traitors. They probably killed Desjardins and Menshikov themselves." Amos's voice boomed across the great room. "Sarah Jacoby, you of all people know that isn't true. You've devoted your life to studying the ways of chaos. You can sense the unleashing of Apophis, can't you? And the return of Ra." Amos pointed out through the glass doors leading to the deck. I don't know how he sensed it without looking, but the sun boat was just floating down, coming to rest in Philip's swimming pool. It was quite an impressive landing. Zia and Walt stood on either side of the throne of fire. They'd managed to prop up Ra, so he looked a bit more regal with his crook and flail in his hands, though he still had a goofy grin on his face. Bast, who'd been standing on the deck, frozen in shock, fell to her knees. "My king." "Hello," Ra warbled. "Goodbye." I wasn't sure what he meant, but Bast shot to her feet, suddenly alarmed. "He's going to rise into the heavens," she said. "Walt, Zia, jump off!" They did, just in time. The sunboat began to glow. Bast turned to me and called, "I'll escort him to the other gods. Don't worry, back soon." She jumped on board, and the sunboat floated into the sky, turning into a ball of fire. Then it blended with the sunlight and was gone. "There is your proof," Amos announced. "The gods and the House of Life must work together. Sadie and Carter are right. The serpent will not stay down for long now that he has broken his chains. Who will join us?" Several enemy magicians threw down their staffs and wands. The woman in white, Sarah Jacoby, snarled, "The other gnomes will never recognize your claim, Cain. You are tainted with the power of Set. We'll spread the word. We'll let them know you murdered Desjardins. They'll never follow you." She leapt through the portal. The man in blue, Kwai, studied us with contempt, then followed Jacoby. Three others did as well, but we let them leave in peace. Reverently, Amos took the leopard-skin cape from Carter's hands. "Poor Michelle." Everyone gathered around the statue of Toth. For the first time, I realized how badly the great room had been damaged. Walls had been cracked, windows broken, relics smashed, and Amos's musical instruments half-melted. For the second time in 3 months, we'd almost destroyed Brooklyn House. That had to be a record. And yet I wanted to give everyone in the room a huge hug. "You all were brilliant," I said. "You destroyed the enemy in seconds. If you can fight so well, how were they able to keep you pinned down all night?" "But we could barely keep them out," Felix said. He looked mystified by his own success. "By dawn, I was like completely out of energy." The others nodded grimly. "And I was in a coma," said a familiar voice. Jazz pushed through the crowd and embraced Carter and me. It was so good to see her. I felt ridiculous that I'd ever been jealous of her and Walt. "You're all right now?" I held her shoulders and studied her face for any sign of sickness, but she looked her usual bubbly self. "I'm fine," she said. "Right at dawn, I woke up feeling great. I guess as soon as you arrived, I don't know, something happened." "The power of Ra," Amos said. "When he rose, he brought new life, new energy to all of us. He revitalized our spirit. Without that, we would have failed." I turned to Walt, not daring to ask, "Was it possible he'd been cured as well?" But the look in his eyes told me that prayer had not been answered. I supposed he could feel the pain in his limbs after doing so much magic. "Weasels are sick," Ra had often repeated. I wasn't sure why Ra was so interested in Walt's condition, but apparently it was beyond even the sun god's power to fix. "Amos," Carter said, interrupting my thoughts, "what did Jacoby mean about the other gnomes not recognizing your claim?" I couldn't help it. I sighed and rolled my eyes at him. My brother can be quite thick sometimes. "What?" he demanded. "Carter," I said, "do you remember our talking about the most powerful magicians in the world? Desjardins was the first, Menshikoff was the third, and you were worried about who the second might be?" "Yeah," he admitted, "but..." "And now that Desjardins is dead, the second most powerful magician is the most powerful magician. And who do you think that is?" Slowly, his brain cells must have fired, which is proof that miracles can happen. He turned to stare at Amos. Our uncle nodded solemnly.
"I'm afraid so, children."
Amos draped the leopard-skin cape around his shoulders.
"Like it or not, the responsibility of leadership falls to me. I am the new chief lector."
24. I make an impossible promise. I don't like goodbyes, and yet I have to tell you about so many of them. "No, Carter, that wasn't an invitation to take the microphone. Push off!" By sunset, Brooklyn House was back in order. Alyssa took care of the masonry almost single-handedly with the power of the Earth God. Our initiates knew the Hyneem spell well enough to fix most of the other broken things. Hufu showed as much dexterity with rags and cleaning fluid as he did with a basketball, and it's truly amazing how much polishing, dusting, and scrubbing one can accomplish by attaching large dusting cloths to the wings of a griffin. We had several meetings during the day. Philip of Macedonia kept guard in the pool, and our Shabti army patrolled the grounds, but no one tried to attack, neither the forces of Apophis nor our fellow magicians. I could almost feel the collective shock spreading through the 360 gnomes as they learned the news. Desjardins was dead. Apophis had risen. Ra was back, and Amos Kane was the new chief lector. Which fact was most alarming to them, I didn't know, but I thought we'd have at least a little breathing space while the other gnomes processed the turn of events and decided what to do. Just before sunset, Carter and I were back on the roof as Zia opened a portal to Cairo for herself and Amos. With her black hair freshly cut and a new set of beige robes, Zia looked like she hadn't changed a bit since we first spoke with her at the Metropolitan Museum, even though so much had happened since then. And I suppose, technically speaking, that hadn't been her at the museum at all, since it was her Shabti. Yes, I know. Horribly confusing to keep track of all that. You should learn the spell for summoning headache medicine. It works wonders. The swirling gate appeared, and Zia turned to say her goodbyes. "I'll accompany Amos, the chief lector, to the first gnome," she promised. "I'll make sure he is recognized as the leader of the house." "They'll oppose you," I said. "Be careful." Amos smiled. "We'll be fine. Don't worry." He was dressed in his usual dapper style, a gold silk suit that matched his new leopard-skin cape, a pork-pie hat, and gold beads in his braided hair. At his side sat a leather duffel bag and a saxophone case. I imagined him sitting on the steps of the pharaoh's throne, playing tenor sax, John Coltrane, perhaps, as a new age unfolded in purple light and glowing hieroglyphs popped out of his horn. "I'll keep in touch," he promised. "Besides, you have things well in hand here at Brooklyn House. You don't need a mentor anymore." I tried to look brave, though I hated his leaving. Just because I was 13 didn't mean I wanted adult responsibilities. Certainly I didn't want to run the 21st gnome or lead armies into war. But I suppose no one who's put in such a position ever feels ready. Zia put her hand on Carter's arm. He jumped as if she'd touched him with a defibrillator paddle. "We'll talk soon," she said, after things have settled. "But thank you." Carter nodded, though he looked crestfallen. We all knew things wouldn't settle any time soon. There was no guarantee we'd even live long enough to see Zia again. "Take care of yourself," Carter said. "You've got an important role to play." Zia glanced at me. A strange sort of understanding passed between us. I think she'd begun to have a suspicion, a deep-seated dread, about what her role might be. I can't say I understood it yet myself, but I shared her disquiet. "Zebras," Ra had said. He'd woken up talking about zebras. "If you need us," I said, "don't hesitate. I'll pop over and give those first gnome magicians a proper thrashing." Amos kissed my forehead. He patted Carter on the shoulder. "You've both made me proud. You've given me hope for the first time in years." I wanted them to stay longer. I wanted to talk with them a bit more. But my experience with Hans had taught me not to be greedy about time. It was best to appreciate what you had and not yearn for more. Amos and Zia stepped through the portal and disappeared. Just as the sun was setting, an exhausted-looking Bast appeared in the great room. Instead of her usual bodysuit, she wore a formal Egyptian dress and heavy jewelry that looked quite uncomfortable.
"I'd forgotten how hard it is riding the sunboat through the sky," she said, wiping her brow. "And hot. Next time I'll bring a saucer and a cooler full of milk."
"Is Ra okay?" I asked. The cat goddess pursed her lips.
"Well, he's the same. I steered the boat to the throne room of the gods. They're getting a fresh crew ready for tonight's journey, but you should come see him before he leaves.
Tonight's journey? Carter asked. Through the Duat? We just brought him back.
Bast spread her hands. What did you expect? You've restarted the ancient cycle. Ra will spend the days in the heavens and the nights on the river. The gods will have to guard him as they used to. Come on, we only have a few minutes.
I was about to ask how she planned on getting us to the gods' throne room. Bast had repeatedly told us she's no good at summoning portals. Then a door of pure shadow opened in the middle of the air. Anubis stepped through, looking annoyingly gorgeous as usual in his black jeans and leather jacket, with a white cotton shirt that hugged his chest so well I wondered if he was showing off on purpose. I suspected not. He probably rolled out of bed in the morning looking that perfect. Right, that image did not help improve my concentration.
Hello, Sadie, he said.
Yes, Carter, he addressed me first, too. What can I say? I'm just that important. I tried to look cross with him. So it's you. Missed you in the underworld while we were gambling our souls away.
Yes, I'm glad you survived, he said. Your eulogy would have been hard to write.
Oh, ha ha, where were you?
Extra sadness crept into his brown eyes. A side project, he said. But right now, we should hurry.
He gestured toward the door of darkness. Just to show him I wasn't afraid, I marched through first. On the other side, we found ourselves in the throne room of the gods. A crowd of assembled deities turned to face us. The palace seemed even grander than the last time we'd been there. The columns were taller, more intricately painted. The polished marble floor swirled with constellation designs, as if we were stepping across the galaxy. The ceiling blazed like one giant fluorescent panel. The dais and throne of Horus had been moved to one side, so it looked more like an observer's chair now, rather than the main event. In the center of the room, the sunboat glowed in dry dock scaffolding. Its light orb crew fluttered about, cleaning the hull and checking the rigging. Uri circled the throne of fire, where Ra sat dressed in the raiment of an Egyptian king, his flail and crook in his lap. His chin was on his chest, and he snored loudly. A muscular young man in leather armor stepped toward us. He had a shaven head and two different colored eyes, one silver, one gold.
"Welcome, Carter and Sadie," Horace said. "We are honored."
His words didn't match his tone, which was stiff and formal. The other gods bowed respectfully to us, but I could feel their hostility simmering just below the surface. They were all dressed in their finest armor and looked quite imposing. Sobek, the crocodile god, not my favorite, wore glittering green chainmail and carried a massive staff that flowed with water. Nekbet looked about as cleaned up as a vulture can, her feathered black cloak silky and plush. She inclined her head to me, but her eyes told me she still wanted to tear me apart. Bobby, the baboon god, had gotten his teeth brushed and his fur combed. He was holding a rugby ball, possibly because Gramps had infected him with the obsession. Hans stood in his glittery silver suit, tossing a coin in the air and smiling. I wanted to punch him, but he nodded as if we were old friends. Even Set was there, in his devilish red disco suit, leaning against a column at the back of the crowd, holding his black iron staff. I remembered that he'd promised not to kill me only until we freed Ra, but at the moment he seemed relaxed. He tipped his hat and grinned at me as if enjoying my discomfort. Toth, the knowledge god, was the only one who hadn't dressed up. He wore his usual jeans and lab coat covered with scribbles. He studied me with his strange kaleidoscope eyes, and I got the feeling he was the only one in the room who actually pitied my discomfort. Isis stepped forward. Her long black hair was braided down behind the shoulders of her gossamer dress. Her rainbow wings shimmered behind her. She bowed to me formally, but I could feel the waves of cold coming off her.
Horace turned to the assembled gods. I realized he was no longer wearing the pharaoh's crown.
"Behold," he told the crowd, "Carter and Sadie Kane, who awakened our king. Let there be no doubt. Apophis the enemy has risen. We must unite behind Ra."
And to the assembled gods, I realized he was no longer wearing the pharaoh's crown.
"Behold," he told the crowd, "Carter and Sadie Kane, who awakened our king. Let there be no doubt. Apophis the enemy has risen. We must unite behind Ra."
Ra muttered in his sleep, "Fish, cookie, weasel," then went back to snoring. Horace cleared his throat.
"I pledge my loyalty. I expect you all to do the same. I will protect Ra's boat as we pass through the Duat tonight. Each of you shall take turns with this duty until the Sun God is fully recovered."
He sounded absolutely unconvinced this would ever happen.
"We will find a way to defeat Apophis," he said. "Now, celebrate the return of Ra. I embrace Carter Kane as a brother."
Music began to play, echoing through the halls. Ra, still on his throne on his boat, woke up and started clapping. He grinned as gods swirled around him, some in human form, some dissolving into wisps of cloud, flame, or light. Isis took my hands.
"I hope you know what you're doing, Sadie,"
she said in a frigid voice.
"Our greatest enemy rises, and you have dethroned my son and made a senile god our leader."
"Give it a chance," I said, though my ankles felt like they were turning to butter. Horace clasped Carter's shoulders. His words weren't any friendlier.
"I am your ally, Carter," Horace promised. "I will lend you my strength whenever you ask. You will revive the path of my magic in the House of Life, and we will fight together to destroy the serpent. But make no mistake. You have cost me a throne. If your choice costs us the war, I swear my last act before Apophis swallows me will be to crush you like a gnat. And if it comes to pass that we win this war without Ra's help, if you have disgraced me for nothing, I swear that the death of Cleopatra and the curse of Akhenaten will look as nothing compared to the wrath I will visit on you and your family for all time. Do you understand?"
To Carter's credit, he held up under the gaze of the war god.
"Just do your part," Carter said.
Horace laughed for the audience as if he and Carter had just shared a good joke.
"Go now, Carter. See what your victory has cost. Let us hope all your allies do not share such a fate."
Horace turned his back on us and joined the celebration. Isis smiled at me one last time and dissolved into a sparkling rainbow. Bast stood at my side, holding her tongue, but she looked as if she wanted to shred Horace like a scratching post. Anubis looked embarrassed.
"I'm sorry, Sadie. The gods can be..."
"Ungrateful?" I asked. "Infuriating?" His face flushed. I suppose he thought I was referring to him.
"We can be slow to realize what is important," he said at last. "Sometimes it takes us a while to appreciate something new, something that might change us for the better."
He fixed me with those warm eyes, and I wanted to melt into a puddle.
"We should go," Bast interrupted. "One more stop, if you're up for it."
"The cast of victory," Carter remembered. "Beth, is he alive?"
Bast sighed. "Difficult question. This way."
The last place I wanted to see again was Sunny Acres. Nothing much had changed in the nursing home. No renewing sunlight had helped the senile gods. They were still wheeling their IV poles around, banging into walls, singing ancient hymns as they searched in vain for temples that no longer existed. A new patient had joined them. Bess sat in a hospital gown in a wicker chair, gazing out the window at the lake of fire. Tawarit knelt at his side, her tiny hippo eyes red from crying. She was trying to get him to drink from a glass. Water dribbled down his chin. He gazed blankly at the fiery waterfall in the distance, his craggy face awash in red light. His curly hair was newly combed, and he wore a fresh blue Hawaiian shirt and shorts, so he looked quite comfortable. But his brow was furrowed. His fingers gripped the armrests, as if he knew he should remember something, but couldn't.
"That's all right, Bess,"
Tawarit's voice quivered as she dabbed a napkin under his chin.
"We'll work on it. I'll take care of you."
Then she noticed us. Her expression hardened. For a kindly goddess of childbirth, Tawarit could look quite scary when she wanted to. She patted the dwarf god's knee.
"I'll be right back, dear Bess."
She stood, which was quite an accomplishment with her swollen belly, and steered us away from his chair.
"How dare you come here, as if you haven't done enough!"
I was about to break into tears and apologize when I realized her anger wasn't aimed at Carter or me. She was glaring at Bast.
"Tawarit."
Bast turned up her palms.
"I didn't want this. He was my friend."
"He was one of your cat toys,"
Tawarit shouted so loudly a few of the patients started crying.
"You're as selfish as all your kind, Bast. You used him and discarded him. You knew he loved you and took advantage of it. You played with him like a mouse under your paw."
"That's not fair,"
Bast murmured, but her hair started to puff up as it does when she's scared. I couldn't blame her. There's almost nothing more frightening than an enraged hippo. Tawarit stomped her foot so hard her high heel broke.
"Bess deserved better than this. He deserved better than you. He had a good heart. I never forgot him."
I sensed a very violent one-sided cat-hippo fight about to begin. I don't know if I spoke up to save Bast or to spare the traumatized patients or to assuage my own guilt, but I stepped between the goddesses. "We'll fix this," I blurted out. "Tawarit, I swear on my life, we will find a way to heal Bess." She looked at me, and the anger drained from her eyes until there was nothing left but pity.
"Child, oh child, I know you mean well, but don't give me false hope. I've lived with false hopes too long. Go, see him if you must. See what's happened to the best dwarf in the world. Then leave us alone. Don't promise me what can't happen."
She turned and hobbled on her broken shoe to the nurse's desk. Bast lowered her head. She wore a very uncat-like expression. Shame.
"I'll wait here," she announced.
I could tell that was her final answer, so Carter and I approached Bess by ourselves. The dwarf god hadn't moved. He sat in his wicker chair, his mouth slightly open, his eyes fixed on the lake of fire. "Bess," I put my hand on his arm, "can you hear me?" He didn't answer, of course. He wore a bracelet on his wrist with his name written in hieroglyphs, lovingly decorated, probably by Tawarit herself. "I'm so sorry," I said. "We'll get your Wren back. We'll find a way to heal you, won't we, Carter?" "Yeah." He cleared his throat, and I can assure you he was not acting very macho at that moment.
"Yeah. I swear it, Bess. If it's..."
He was probably going to say, "if it's the last thing we do," but he wisely decided against it. Given the impending war with Apophis, it was best not to think about how soon our lives might end. I leaned down and kissed Bess's forehead. I remembered how we'd met at Waterloo Station when he'd chauffeured Liz and Emma and me to safety. I remembered how he'd scared away Neckbet and Bobby in his ridiculous speedo. I thought about the silly chocolate Lenin head he'd bought in St. Petersburg, and how he'd pulled Walt and me to safety from the portal at Red Sands. I couldn't think of him as small. He had an enormous, colourful, ludicrous, wonderful personality, and it seemed impossible that it was gone forever.
He'd given his immortal life to buy us one extra hour. I couldn't help sobbing. Finally, Carter had to pull me away. I don't remember how we got back home, but I remember feeling as if we were falling rather than ascending, as if the mortal world had become a deeper and sadder place than anywhere in the Duat. That evening, I sat alone on my bed with the windows open. The first night of spring had turned surprisingly warm and pleasant. Lights glittered along the riverfront. The neighborhood bagel factory filled the air with the scent of baking bread. I was listening to my sad playlist and wondering how it was possible that my birthday had been only a few days ago. The world had changed. The sun god had returned, Apophis was free from his cage, and although he'd been banished to some deep part of the abyss, he'd be working his way back very quickly. War was coming. We had so much work to do. Yet I was sitting here, listening to the same songs as before, staring at my poster of Anubis and feeling helplessly conflicted about something as trivial and infuriating as... yes, you guessed it. Boys. There was a knock at the door. "Come in," I said without much enthusiasm. I assumed it was Carter. We often chatted at the end of the day, just to debrief. Instead, it was Walt. And suddenly I was very aware that I was wearing a ratty old T-shirt and pajama bottoms. My hair, no doubt, looked as horrible as neckbeds. Carter's seeing me this way wouldn't be a problem. But Walt? Bad. "What are you doing here?" I yelped a bit too loudly. He blinked, obviously surprised by my lack of hospitality. "Sorry, I'll go." "No, I mean, that's all right. You just surprised me. And, you know... we have rules about boys being in the girls' rooms without, supervision." I realized that sounded terribly stodgy of me, almost Carter-esque, but I was nervous. Walt folded his arms. They were very nice arms. He was wearing his basketball jersey and running shorts, his usual collection of amulets around his neck. He looked so healthy, so athletic, it was difficult to believe he was dying of an ancient curse. "Well, you're the instructor," he said. "Can you supervise me?" No doubt I was blushing horribly. "Right. I suppose if you leave the door ajar... what brings you here?" He leaned against the closet door. With some horror, I realized it was still open, revealing my poster of Anubis. "There's so much going on," Walt said. "You've got enough to worry about. I don't want you worrying about me as well." "Too late," I admitted. He nodded, as if he shared my frustration. "That day in the desert, at Baharia, would you think I'm crazy if I tell you that was the best day of my life?" My heart fluttered, but I tried to stay calm. "Well, Egyptian public transportation, roadside bandits, smelly camels, psychotic Roman mummies, and possessed date farmers. Gosh, it was quite a day." "And you?" he said. "Yes, well... I suppose I belong in that list of catastrophes." "That's not what I meant." I was feeling like quite a bad supervisor, nervous and confused and having very unsupervisory thoughts. My eyes strayed to the closet door. Walt noticed. "Oh." He pointed to Anubis. "You want me to close this?"
"Yes," I said. "No, possibly. I mean, it doesn't matter. Well, not that it doesn't matter, but..."
Walt laughed as if my discomfort didn't bother him at all.
"Sadie, look, I just wanted to say, whatever happens, I'm glad I met you. I'm glad I came to Brooklyn. Jazz is working on a cure for me. Maybe she'll find something. But either way, it's okay."
"It's not okay!" I think my anger surprised me more than it did him. "Walt, you're dying of a bloody curse, and I had Menshikov right there, ready to tell me the cure, and I failed you, like I failed Bess. I didn't even bring back Ra properly." I was furious with myself for crying, but I couldn't help it. Walt came over and sat next to me. He didn't try to put his arm around me, which was just as well. I was already confused enough.
"You didn't fail me," he said. "You didn't fail anybody. You did what was right, and that takes sacrifice."
"Not you," I said. "I don't want you to die."
His smile made me feel as if the world had been reduced to just two people.
Ra's return may not have cured me, he said, but it still gave me new hope. You're amazing, Sadie. One way or another, we're going to make this work. I'm not leaving you.
That sounded so good, so excellent, and so impossible. How can you promise that?
His eyes drifted to the picture of Anubis, then back to me.
Just try not to worry about me. We have to concentrate on defeating Apophis.
Any idea how?
He gestured toward my bedside table, where my beaten-up old tape recorder sat, a gift from my grandparents ages ago.
Tell people what really happened, he said. Don't let Jacoby and the others spread lies about your family. I came to Brooklyn because I got your first message, the recording about the Red Pyramid, the Jed amulet. You asked for help, and we answered. It's time to ask for help again.
But how many magicians did we really reach the first time? 20?
Hey, we did pretty well last night.
Walt held my eyes. I thought he might kiss me, but something made us both hesitate, a sense that it would only make things more uncertain, more fragile.
Send out another tape, Sadie. Just tell the truth. When you talk...
He shrugged and then stood to leave.
Well, you're pretty hard to ignore.
A few moments after he left, Carter came in, a book tucked under his arm. He found me listening to my sad music, staring at the tape recorder on the dresser.
"Was that Walt coming out of your room?" he asked.
A little brotherly protectiveness crept into his voice.
"What's up?"
"Oh, just..." My eyes fixed on the book he was carrying. It was a tattered old textbook, and I wondered if he meant to assign me some sort of homework. But the cover looked so familiar. The diamond design, the multicolored foil letters...
"What is that?"
Carter sat next to me. Nervously, he offered me the book.
"It's, not a gold necklace, or even a magic knife, but I told you I had a birthday present for you. This is it."
I ran my fingers over the title. "Blackley's Survey of the Sciences for First Year College, 12th Edition." Then I opened the book. On the inside cover, a name was written in lovely cursive. Ruby Kane. It was Mum's college textbook, the same one she used to read to us from at bedtime, the very same copy. I blinked back tears. "How did you..."
"The retrieval sharpie in the library," Carter said. "They can find any book. I know it's kind of a lame present. It didn't cost me anything, and I didn't make it, but..."
"Shut up, you idiot!" I flung my arms around him. "It's an amazing birthday present, and you're an amazing brother!"
"Fine, Carter. There it is, recorded for all time. Just don't get a big head." I spoke in a moment of weakness.
We turned the pages, smiling at the crayon moustache Carter had drawn on Isaac Newton and the outdated diagrams of the solar system. We found an old food stain that was probably my applesauce. I loved applesauce. We ran our hands over the margin notes done in Mum's beautiful cursive. I felt closer to my mother just holding the book, and amazed by Carter's thoughtfulness. Even though I'd learned his secret name and supposed I knew everything about him, the boy had still managed to surprise me.
"So, what were you saying about Walt?" he asked. "What's going on?"
Reluctantly, I closed Blackley's Survey of the Sciences. And yes, that's probably the only time in my life I've ever closed a textbook with reluctance. I rose and set the book on my dresser. Then I picked up my old cassette recorder. "We have work to do," I told Carter. I tossed him the microphone. "So now you know what really happened on the equinox, how the old chief lector died, and how Amos took his place. Desjardins sacrificed his life to buy us time, but Apophis is quickly working his way out of the abyss. We may have weeks if we're lucky, days if we're not. Amos is trying to assert himself as the leader of the House of Life, but it's not going to be easy.
Some gnomes are in rebellion. Many believe the Kanes have taken over by force. We're sending out this tape to set the record straight. We don't have all the answers yet. We don't know when or where Apophis will strike. We don't know how to heal Ra, or Bess, or even Walt. We don't know what role Zia will play, or if the gods can be trusted to help us. Most important, I am completely torn between two amazing guys, one who's dying and another who's the god of death. What sort of choice is that, I ask you? Right, sorry, getting off track again. The point is, wherever you are, whatever type of magic you practice, we need your help. Unless we unite and learn the path of the gods quickly, we don't stand a chance. I hope Walt is right, and you'll find me hard to ignore, because the clock is ticking. We'll keep a room ready for you at Brooklyn House.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Throne of Fire by Rick Riordan. Copyright 2011 by Rick Riordan. Performed by Kevin R. Free and Catherine Kellgren. Directed by Mae Wetherich. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliance-audio.com. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.